라디오 CDC.
라디오 CDC.
라디오 Casa del Caracol. Hi everyone, welcome on our program Radio Casa del Caracol. Today we have a special guest. He is studying neuroscience at the University of California, Irvine, and he will explain us a bit more about what he is doing, how does work this program, this medicine program is doing, because he's still like a student. And he will explain us a bit more also about the research he is doing in neuroscience. So hi, Druba, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Cool. Thank you for helping us to learn a bit more about this huge topic in medicine, the neuroscience. But first of all, can you explain me what is this program you came in? So now you are not a doctor already. You're still a student, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So I joined a program they have here in the U.S. called a MD-PhD program. And it's a combined program where it takes many years, but it's fulfilling because what you do is you study medicine at medical school, but you also study science or some other subject in graduate school. And you do the graduate level work in both of those things, and you finish with both degrees.
Okay, cool. And so in your personal path, the program you choose, so now you are doing a research. And can you explain us a bit more which kind of research it is? Because it's like something really specific on the brain, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So the point of these programs is that you're supposed to learn how to do science so that you can go and apply it to medicine and find out more about human health and hopefully make some, you know, good advancements. But once you're on the research side of things, things are very specific and, you know, you're working out details of little things which add up over time to, you know, new discoveries that help people in their health and to live better. So the research that I'm doing is I'm in a neurobiology lab that studies how brains are adjusting over development and how the brains maintain plasticity initially, which means, you know, they're able to change and whatnot in the face of different environmental conditions. And then over time, they lose this plasticity and they become kind of set in their ways. And so I'm in a lab that studies this in the part of the brain that controls vision.
Okay, cool. And so what is the purpose of that? Like, are you like exploring to learn more about something, or do you have like a goal, an aim in helping people to get cure of things? Do you have any example?
Yeah, I think I have I guess I came to medical school because I have a general interest in this kind of work. I think it would be really fulfilling if your, you know, life's work is something where you go and you develop something that helps a lot of people with something that they struggle with. I'm still kind of exploring what exactly I want to be very committed to, but I know that one thing that really interests me is how can we enact change in people? And that change can be anything from somebody who has, you know, spinal cord damage due to like a car accident or something like this. And we need to figure out how to make the neurons, so the cells of the brain that are now cut off, how do we make them, you know, regrow appropriately and regain function of, say, your lower limbs, to, you know, changes that are more psychological in nature. You know, if somebody has an addiction to something, how do you change the brain so that it the person can kind of choose whether or not to keep engaging in a particular activity or a particular substance or leave it out of their own volition. So something about changes of behavior and the nervous system is a topic that really fascinates me and has led me to do this kind of research.
How much do we know on the brain?
we know a lot, I would say. I know that often you don't hear that, but I think we've learned a lot about the brain. There's many people working on it, and I think it's helped because generally this is a very interesting topic to many people. So there's an interest in learning more from the general public, which is, I think we all really appreciate. But then we also realize when we get into these things that the brain is so complicated that even though whatever we know, there's much more to know after that. And so that's an undeniable truth. You know, you feel like you've achieved something when you learn something new, but you also see the mountain in front of you of everything that you have to, you know. And I think the brain is also one of these topics in science which is a frontier, because there are areas where we don't even have an idea where to start, in a way. Like, we can work out details until we understand, like, until we realize what that approach should be. But it's just such a frontier of knowledge.
And so right now, the research you are doing, it's for 2 years. How long you've been starting, and do you have, like, a question you have to answer to? How does it work, research like this? And you have just a certain period of time, you have just a certain amount of time to do it. So I do imagine you also maybe are working with the work of people have done before, probably. So can you speak about this research a bit more, like, how does it work, and on what are you looking exactly right now? What would be a regular day in the biology lab?
Yeah, certainly. So just for some context, I've done 2 years so far, but that has been a medical school. So I've done the first 2 years out of the four that medical schools in the U.S. have. And now I'm just starting off in a laboratory that studies plasticity, like I said, you know, how the brain changes in the visual system. And so I'm just getting started on that, and I'll be working on a very specific question in there for the next 4 to 5 years before I come back to medical school to finish up my last 2 years. And the question that I'm going to kind of try to tackle is going to be very specific. You know, I have an idea of what it is, but you never know where the path leads you, and it might change over time. But I think you're very right in that everybody who does research adds a little piece to something that is going on in the background, and everybody's contributing. So I'm coming in and I'm trying to understand, in this case, how a particular region of the brain that is visually active, as in when you see things, this area of the brain really processes the information that are coming in through your eyes. How does this region process information and incorporate new information when you learn something new? So for example, you can go through your day and every day you see some of the same things, right? Maybe you go into work every day and you see the same thing, but one day you go into work and everything is different. Somehow the chairs are all in different places and the desks are flipped over or something like this. It's very unexpected. So this information is coming in through your vision, but it's very new. It doesn't meet your expectations. There's reason for us to believe that the area of the brain that I'm looking at is, you know, very activated by this kind of surprise. And I want to understand, how does this surprise, first of all, get understood in the brain? How is it represented in the brain? And also, how does that surprise and that representation kind of change your existing understanding of that scene?
Is it like something they do in ads, you know, like the work on ad, the people who create in communication ad, they try to surprise the people, the fact that they try to make them remembering pictures or words, right? Like, to make it like surprising you, and you should remember it in just one sight, you know?
Yeah, I think people probably do utilize things like this to kind of, you know, whenever you're surprised, there's systems in the brain that, you know, indicate your surprise. There's, for example, a neuromodulator called acetylcholine, which is released every time there's something like very surprising happens and you become more alert. So if the advertisement wants you to pay attention, maybe they'll use something like this. And I think this is a really interesting point, because in neuroscience, I think a reason a lot of us went into it is because at heart, we really want to understand what makes us human. And there's many people who have gone through the world and really realized these things. Like they've realized that surprise is an effective way to sell something, for example, and they use it. But I think the neuroscientists are the people who also maybe realize it. But what we really want to know is how does the brain do this? Because the brain is doing it somehow, and we want to understand the mechanism. But undoubtedly, the same things that we're investigating, you know, are things that people have written about in poetry, are things that people in business have used to sell products, are things that, you know, are just aspects and facets of our life.
And which kind of tools do you use to make this investigation? Are you working with human, animals, machine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in neuroscience, speaking broadly, people use a variety of different techniques to do it. So to give you some examples before I say my specific one, some people work with humans and they do things like brain scanning with a functional magnetic resonance imaging. Other people do work with computers and all they do all day is make models and do computational neuroscience. Other people use model organisms. So these are organisms that we can do experiments on that would be unethical to do on humans, but have a lot of advantages. And we think that if we understand how the brain and the neurons, the cells in the brain, you know, change in these organisms, then we can also kind of extrapolate that information to how cells in the humans change. So these model organisms come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. Some of them are like the zebrafish, which is this tiny little fish that kind of swims around and has a transparent head. So you can look at the cells within the head very easily with a microscope. And you can also see, you know, how are those cells controlling its little tail as it's wiggling along, you know? Mm-hmm. People use worms, people use a songbird. People use all sorts
songbirds.
Of songbirds, yeah. So birds, for example, are really interesting because if a songbird sings, it learns how to sing from its dad, right? So there's a parent who teaches it how to sing. And you can analyze the sounds that a songbird makes to see how the next generation first learns the new song and then changes the song in a way that suits its needs. And then you can understand the neurophysiology behind this too. What I use is mice. So a lot of laboratories use rodents, which are mammals. So there's some reason to think that whatever happens in their brains is similar to ours. And so some people use rats and some people use mice. And I use mice because there's also a lot of genetic control over mice. So you can have types of mice that can reveal interesting things towards your research. And so what we do is we take these mice and then we have them watch virtual reality. So we kind of surround them with visual stimulus and we have them kind of run around on a wheel and control kind of what they're seeing and move around in this virtual environment. And then we change the environment on them. So we change it because it's virtual reality and we have control over it. And we look at kind of how surprised they are behaviorally. You know, do they look like they're very taken aback by these new things? And we also look at their brains to see, you know, as they're doing this, what are the cells responding? You know, which cells are responding and how are they responding? So then we do imaging and things like this too.
Okay, so you use a machine and you put maybe connection to the brain. And so is it the way you can see that?
Yeah, so the best way to explain it is that what we do is we use a microscope. But a very advanced type of microscope that allows you to kind of look for glowing objects. Now, why would there be a glowing object, you might ask? Well, that's where the reason we use mice comes in. So we have mice that are like normal mice, but in specific cells, they're genetically changed to glow when you shine a certain wavelength of light on them. So basically, we can shine one wavelength of light on the brain, and then the only the cells that are active and are the type that we want will glow a different wavelength of light back, which our microscope will pick up. So basically, as this mouse is running around, we just keep shining this light in a very patterned kind of way, and we get the output of that light, and we collect that information to see, oh, this cell is glowing right now. That must mean this cell likes whatever is happening in the virtual reality environment. Or this cell is associated with its little paws as it's running around or something like this. So it's a type of microscopy that we're using in order to kind of look at the cells of the brain.
Are you looking to find a way to cure human visual disease, or is it just about a question of understanding?
Yeah, so I think both ways. So there are human diseases that are very pertinent to some of the things that the lab studies. For example, one disease is amblyopia, which happens when you have really bad vision in one of your eyes. And if you go through this period of development, as in you go through your childhood years with this poor vision in one eye, then the brain doesn't form the proper connections to the eye, and you won't be able to kind of see through that eye, even in later life. So this is something that's worth correcting. But it also, you have to ask the question, you know, where is this problem happening? And is it correctable? So you have to look at the brain and the visual input that's coming into the brain to understand, okay, this is where the input is traveling. These are the parts of it that are not developing well when amblyopia happens. And how can you go in and maybe change that, you know? So you have to really understand the brain circuitry, because this is not a problem of the eye. The eye is fine. It's a problem with the brain and the connections it's making. So that's, for example, one question. But I think there are also questions that this could potentially answer for human health further down the line, because this experience of surprise kind of underlies, you know, how do we take information from the world and we put it into our brain, which is kind of how you store, for example, a memory, right? A memory is some sort of a understanding of the world that you got through experience, and you've incorporated into your background knowledge of the world, right? So when you look at many diseases that have to do with learning deficits or memory impairments, losing memories, it's very possible that these areas are, you know, you're losing memory because there's damage to these areas. And in fact, the area of the brain that I'm looking at right now is one of the earliest areas of the brain that's affected in Alzheimer's disease. So there's reason to think that this is an area that's implicated, certainly, in the disease. And figuring out kind of how it's incorporating information will at least lead to some sort of a knowledge that in the future could be used.
So the mice, they have the same disease as us? Or do you create the situation to explore the disease you were talking about before? Or maybe have to work with human, but how do you manage to do that? Is it the animal who is having like the most closest vision as us?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. If you have mice and you're trying to investigate a particular disease, then more generally speaking, there's different mouse lines. For example, this is again where the genetics comes in. You can, if you, for example, know that one genetic deficit causes a particular disease, you can go in and you can actually make that change in the mouse and see, kind of get a mouse that's the mouse equivalent of somebody who has that disease, right?
Or do you do that? Or do you control the genetic at which moment? At the moment where there is the reproduction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's many different techniques for how you can control the genetics. It can be at that stage, at the embryonic stage, or it can be at a much later stage, like with something like a... and a lot of this becomes very science fiction-like, but, you know, there's techniques like you can put a virus in that will deliver a particular gene into the mouse's body. And it's cool because this could be a way that you can introduce different things to human bodies too, you know, in order to deactivate cells that are cancerous or other things. So these are very interesting, you know, pioneering things that are happening in mice, but could one day, you know, benefit humans as well. But to go back to your question about amblyopia, the disease I talked about, where you have impaired vision in one eye, and as a result, the brain doesn't form properly. You can induce this in a mouse because you can take a mouse that's also a, you know, in that developmental stage where it really needs to be able to see, and you can just kind of close one of their eyes. And so as a result, you're not giving the mouse the proper visual information during that period. But just after 4 days, you can open that eye again. And even though the eye is fine and the mouse, it can go around the world, you find that the mouse can't really see very well through that eye that was closed. So this is kind of the equivalent of somebody who, for example, has a lazy eye or some other impairment in one eye. Even if it gets corrected in a age that's too late, then that person will not be able to utilize the information coming in through that eye.
So maybe it's like you're looking to found a way to recreate the connection between the information and the tool, because you were saying like the eye was okay, mm-hmm. like the tool is okay. Mm-hmm. One of the, so each eye, the right and mm-hmm. the left eye, they are both tools. Mm-hmm. So one of those two tools is working and it gets useful tool to mm-hmm. process information or to send the information for the brain to process it. Mm-hmm. And the other one, he is the tool also, mm-hmm. but he is not connected mm-hmm. or he cannot send the information to the brain to process it. Is it like something like this?
Yeah.
You're trying to find to rebuild the connection, but it's not about the eye. The eye has no issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think it's still an open question as to which connection is the problem. You know, is it the connection that's, you know, right at the brain once the information reaches there? Is it a midway point in between those two things that's also, you know, problematic? Is it not where the eye information reaches the brain, but further in the brain, somewhere later in the processing? So these are, you know, important questions that are hard to answer, but we have some ideas about it. And I think having these ideas about it is useful because then you know kind of what area of the brain you even have to kind of start to think about. But this is kind of more the focus of the lab. But I think one of the things that really intrigues me is, okay, so you have somebody who has this issue. How do you fix that if they didn't get it fixed while they were a child? You have to somehow do something as an adult, but that's very hard to do. If people have amblyopia and they don't get it corrected, you know, as a child, then oftentimes they will have this problem throughout their life without any hope. Now, one thing that's really interesting to me is initially this is a problem because you didn't get enough input from the environment. You didn't see enough things from that eye and it didn't form the connections properly. So I'm very interested in how you can kind of introduce stimulus or, you know, something that's stimulation later visually to reform these circuits. So as in, how can you open up a period in a later age when your brain is again sensitive and receptive to outside stimulus?
Okay, I see. Wow, it's really interesting. What would be a regular day in the lab?
Yeah, it varies a lot. So this is something I like about research and is different from kind of many other jobs where you're maybe just at a desk. My day can be anything from kind of building these virtual reality setups to doing kind of bench work where you're at the bench and you're pipetting and things like this, to using that microscope to collect data, analyzing the data again on the computer, 3D printing parts that I need for my experiment. So, you know, designing these files and printing them. It's just kind of, you have this project and you are the one that goes and does all the little pieces to make this overall thing work.
You are many people in the lab, isn't it? So you are all working on the same things, or do you have a specific role?
Yeah, a lot of people have their own different projects. I'm lucky enough that in this project, for example, I'm collaborating with someone, so I get to work with somebody the whole time. Sometimes that's the case. Other times people are kind of doing their own project. I think overall we're in the lab because the projects have some sort of a theme that connects them all. So, you know, for us, it's development and processing of information in the visual system. So that's the theme that connects us all. But somebody else will be working on a question that's very different from mine.
You are the only one who is doing your schedule. I mean, there is no one who is saying, Dhruba, you have to do this in the morning and this in the afternoon. It's your own schedule. You manage it by yourself. And also, like, in all this team, like, if you need some help, I imagine, to learn how to work the microscope, for example, or things like that, you will always find a good rescue for that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that a lot of people like about research, and is generally the case, is that we don't have so many restrictions about you have to come in at this time or you have to do this during the morning. There's a flexibility about it. Now, I think despite the flexibility, everybody I've met in research works really hard and works like very long hours. But the interesting part is that it's very self-motivated because you have a lot of, you know, it's your project. Whether it fails or succeeds is kind of partly up to you. So everybody wants, you know, at least that aspect of it to work out, because in addition, there's luck and things that you can't control. So no one is kind of making my schedule. I'm just kind of thinking, all right, I have to do this and that to get this project one step closer to, you know, getting an answer to the questions. And what's really nice about lab is that there's people who are coming in at different times, and all of us kind of are contributing maybe something new, where we find out how to work out and use some new material or try a new experiment. But at the same time, there's this collective knowledge between us about how different things work. And, you know, if you're in a good lab environment like I am, it's very easy to ask people, you know, hey, how do you do this thing? Or, you know, ask for advice or ask for help with your technique on something. And people who've been there longer and have done that before me are more than happy to, you know, help. And I've generally seen that's the case in research. It's a very collaborative experience.
Cool. So it seems that you are really well surrounded. That's really nice. Do you do like a work meetings or like a workshop together? There is like a moment in the week where you are sharing just to be sure, like, I'm working on this and I did that. Do you do that kind of things, or sometimes you feel like a bit alone?
Yeah, that's interesting point, because a lot of labs do have like a work meeting, like they call it lab meetings, where the professor whose lab it is, you know, gathers everybody in the lab together, and maybe one person presents about their work so that everybody knows about it. The lab that I'm in has been so far small enough that it hasn't been necessary to do a lab meeting, but maybe in the future we will, you know, do it as we grow. But I think I don't feel so isolated because, as I said, it's a small lab. So it's easy if you have something interesting to show, you know, you grab the person who's going to get water next to you. Hey, come look at this, or something like that. And I'm getting to work on this in a collaborative way with another person, which means we also get to share kind of, you know, what we're finding and things like this too.
Thank you so much for all this. So I have one more question. You have 5 years to do that. This research. Do you have to write a thesis? Mm-hmm. Do you have like a certain amount of pages you have to write? There is a rule with that. Are you writing right now? Because I have heard that sometimes it's a issue to start to write it, and you have this pressure of there is an average of pages you should do.
I don't think we have an average number of pages. I think even though there is the thesis that's at the very end that marks, you know, you have done enough work to finish your PhD, there's a lot of steps in the middle where you have to apply to things like grants for money or to write papers, which are basically the thing that allows your science and your work to be seen by the broader community of scientists. So all of these things will be writings as well. And I think the thesis really ends up being a compilation of some of the work that you've already done. So the thesis itself, you know, you do have to write it well, and it usually ends up being kind of long. But there's many writing opportunities before that that'll be in a way more significant and will frame how your thesis goes anyway. So I think it's not like certain fields where really the thesis is the main thing, you know, that's the thing that people look back on and say, ah, that was the work in the PhD. I think in our field, in neurobiology, people will look more likely at the papers that you've published, so the scientific articles that you've written through your period.
Okay. You have to publish an article every month?
Oh, no. No. These things take years to finish, you know, depending on how the scope of your experiment. Some experiments are shorter, others are longer, but very much like on average, they take years to finish. And so really, I think, you know, and it's very nebulous because your PhD is finished when a committee of professors decides you've done enough. So there's no clear, you know, thing about now you're done. But I think as a rule of thumb, something that's an easy way to see it is that if you've published one major paper and you've been the first author, meaning you've made the most significant contribution to that paper, that's usually a sign that, okay, you've shown that you know how to do the scientific process and you're ready to graduate. And this standard might vary from department to department and school to school too. But I think generally that's like a sign that, you know, you've at least done something there.
And how many pages is the paper? Like, is it something big? I do imagine that you already read some of those, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. These papers go out to scientific journals of different types, and actually the page limits are more dictated by the journal. So, for example, the journal you send it to will say, you know, for our articles of this type, you can have a maximum of this many words, you can have this many figures, and really what you're trying to do in that journal, the objective of the scientist is to make a point, you know, you try to make some sort of a claim. And you have to back that claim up with a sufficient amount of evidence. So I think one of the things I like about science compared to, you know, other ways, you know, we talked about how people have thought about the brain and the mind in various ways, from artists to businessmen, right? But I think what I like about the scientific approach to understanding the mind is that there is a credibility that comes with a claim, because you have to show evidence. You have to actually show your data that supports your idea. And so your paper is a way for you to make an argument. And so it's not so much that people are concerned about they have to write so much. In fact, oftentimes it's the opposite. How can I convincingly make a case for what I want to claim with the limitations of the number of pictures that I can put in, of my graphs, or the limits of the number of words and things like this?
Okay. So you start like few times ago. So you haven't started to write anything. And if you're still in the exploration or things like that.
That's right. I mean, I'm writing things like grants where I ask people for money so that I can go and do my experiments, you know. So that's kind of a writing process of itself. But there you're more talking about the things that you will do and if you, you know, get the resources. And so there as well, you have to kind of collect your thoughts and think about the experiments and why those are right experiments to do. And so these are things that I'm writing now and thinking about. But it's too early for me to write a paper because I don't have, you know, results that I can make a claim on.
Cool. Thank you very much, Ruba. It was really nice to explore this world of neurobiology, science and lab and research. Thank you so much. Have a really, really great time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, our dear followers, to be fan of our programs and listen to us. We love you. We are broadcasting from California, Irvine, exactly, the town of Irvine. And we hope you are enjoying your day. Bye-bye.